Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Kate Seeley, Senior Vice President of the Middle East Institute, and I want to welcome you to today's event entitled Assessing Iran's Support for Regional Militias. It's our pleasure to host Mr. Fuad Hamdan, Executive Director of the Rule of Law Foundation, based in The Hague. He's also the campaign director for the public information group Naam-e-Sham, or Letter from Syria. As stated on their website, Naam-e-Sham is an independent campaign group focusing on the Iranian regime's role in Syria, comprised of a group of Iranian, Lebanese, and Syrian activists and citizen journalists who coordinate information gathering about Iran. Today, Fuad's organization is sharing with us their latest report seeking to quantify Iran's financial support for the Assad regime, as well as regional militias like Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas and Islamic Jihad in the Gaza Strip, Shia militias in Iraq, and the Houthi militia in Yemen. In mid-November, Fuad briefed the European Parliament on the basis of the report that he's releasing here today, and it's entitled Financing Terror, the Economic Impact of Iran's Nuclear Program and Its Support to Paramilitary Groups Across the Middle East. And I hope you all had a chance to pick up a copy. We'll be talking quite a bit about it today. Before joining the Rule of Law Foundation, Fuad worked with Arab political parties and civil society groups on campaign and communication strategies. He was the founding executive director of the Arab Human Rights Fund in Beirut in 2008, an organization that gives grants to regional activists. He's also had an extensive career in environmental activism. He founded Greenpeace in Lebanon in 1994, a very active NGO, as I recall from my days in Beirut, and was the director of Friends of the Earth Europe in Brussels. Fuad will speak about 15 to 20 minutes, fairly briefly, and then he really wants to open the floor to extensive discussion. Before I invite Fuad up, though, just one final housekeeping note. I just want to mention our very final event of the year on Wednesday at the Carnegie Endowment. I should note that we have had an incredibly busy year. We put on 7 conferences, something like 80 panels and roundtables, and we're all exhausted. But Wednesday is our very last one. We're partnering with Jim Zogby of the Arab American Institute for a look at his latest polling on views across 8 countries in the Middle East. Joining Jim Zogby in discussion are Jessica Ashu and Barbara Slavin of the Atlantic Council and Hassan Meneme and Paul Salem of Middle East Institute. So please join us for our last event of the year. And now I'd like to welcome Mr. Hamdan to the stage.
Thank you, Kate. Thank you, everybody from the Middle East Institute, for hosting me for the third time now here in the past, during the past year. Please pick up a copy of the report there, and you have also copies of our policy recommendations to end the Syria war, and the press release about the report, and a paper called New Narrative about the Syria war and the Syria conflict. Maybe a couple of sentences more about who we are. We are a group of, you know, Iranian, Lebanese, and Syrian activists. We all live in exile in Europe, basically. I can't go anymore to Beirut since 2 years because of that campaign. You will laugh. We are all Shia, you know, funnily. But we don't like the Iranian regime, not because they're Shia. It's because of their policies. We are very secular to the bones, all of us, just for your information. And we are funded by 2 personal friends of mine who fund all this operation. It's about 420,000 euros for the past 2 years. And we are totally politically independent. This is very important to notice because we don't take any funding from a government or something related to any government or political party and so on. I'm going to give you a small summary of the main findings of that report and give you also our opinion about why this war is still going on in Syria and what needs to be done to end it. This report, you know, details the Iranian regime's basically lavish expenditure on financing terrorist activities in groups in Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, Palestine, and Yemen. In Syria, since the beginning of the revolution in March 2011, Iran has been propping up the killing machine of the Assad regime with $3 to $5 billion annually. This is a very conservative estimate. And this aid has contributed to the death of over 300,000 people, the displacement of more than 7 million people, and about 4 million refugees to neighboring countries, many of whom have been almost swimming now to Europe. Iran provided to the Palestinian Hamas with $100 to $250 million between 2007 and 2011, and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad received from Iran $100 to $150 million annually since 2007. The Houthi militia in Yemen received $10 to $25 million since 2010, partly in cash, but mostly in the form of training and arms. Hezbollah Lebanon has been very much involved in training the Houthi militias in Yemen. In summary, Iran has spent in Syria, in Lebanon, in Palestine for Hamas and Islamic Jihad, and in Yemen between $20 and $80 billion. We've been very conservative about these figures, and the report has been done for us by a European Economic Research Institute that wished to remain anonymous for security reasons. They changed their mind a day before we went to print and did not want their name to be published. And we decided together to use only extremely reliable Western sources for this report. You know, if you want to be a bit more relaxed about it, you'll be around $100 billion at least, what Iran has spent during all the periods I mentioned before and to the five groups in these five countries. So we believe that the figure is much higher, especially basically also in Syria. Beware, we did not include in our report the following calculations. Rebuilding parts of Lebanon after the Israel-Hezbollah war in 2006, it was about $2 billion. Compensation for the thousands of dead troops, soldiers, militiamen in Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, who fought and died for Iran. We're talking about Hezbollah militiamen, we're talking about Afghani, Iraqi militiamen, we're talking about the Revolutionary Guards who died there. And the costs of Iran's sleeping cells all over the world. We know we have hundreds of Hezbollah sleeping cells all over the world, you know, waiting for the day where Iran will say, do something. Yeah, they cost money. We don't know how much that costs. And, of course, the cost of the numerous terrorist attacks that have been funded and organized and carried out by Iranians or by people, Hezbollah people, working for Iran since the early 1980s in several parts of the world, be it Latin America, Europe, or the Arab region. All these costs are not inside that report. So, why did we do this report? You know, following the nuclear deal signed between the West and Iran in July 2015, the Iranian regime will have access next year between $100 and $150 billion in addition to revenues from oil export. Some of this cash will definitely be used to prop up the ailing economy of Iran. But we know for certain that a lot of that money will be also used to finance the regime's terrorist activities and destabilizing policies in Syria and elsewhere in the Middle East. That's for sure. How much will be sent here and there, we don't know yet. I don't think even the Iranians know it yet. They will know next year when they will get the first money after implementing, hopefully, the nuclear deal. So be assured that the Iranian Revolutionary Guards will soon have much more money to splash on their disastrous adventures once international sanctions are lifted as part of the July 2015 nuclear deal. And we expect the focus of that funding will be in 2016 Syria, Lebanon, Iraq. Yemen, I think they're losing it, but the other countries, they're going to focus a lot of their money there. Our report also looks at the costs of Iran's military nuclear program. The nuclear program, the civilian one. We estimate that Iran has spent on its only nuclear reactor in Bushehr about $11 billion. And they spent a very unclear amount of money into building their military nuclear capabilities. You know, the enrichment of uranium, the heavy water reactor, Natanz, and so on. We don't know exactly how much money they spent there. We did not want to speculate, so we don't have these figures inside. But the figure we know is that the cost of the Iranian nuclear program for the economy, because of all the sanctions they were hit with, is about $100 billion. When one takes into consideration the indirect costs, especially those caused by the international sanctions imposed on the country in relation to its military nuclear activities. $100 billion it cost them, the sanctions alone. Iran's nuclear program, from our opinion, and I'm talking here now as a former Greenpeace activist, makes absolutely little economic sense when looking at the costs of energy production. considering economic factors as well as the geography of Iran, a strategy to quit high carbon and nuclear energy generation and invest in alternative renewable energy sources is more economically and environmentally viable for the country. And the potential for attracting foreign investments when pursuing a renewable energy path may be definitely more promising for Iran. So when you ask yourself, why did they put so much money in the nuclear energy plan? And they always claim it's only for civilian peaceful purposes, which is a lie, of course, and we know it all. They wanted to have the bomb, and they still want to have the bomb, and we believe they will never give up having to have the bomb. Back to the White House now. So the U.S. administration has promised that the nuclear deal will be fully implemented in 2016. We hope so. And we hope they will really implement it 100%. Or crippling economic sanctions against Iran will remain in place or be reactivated. But the question is, what is President Obama's strategy to counter the expected rise in the Iranian regime's financing of terror by the Assad regime, Hezbollah, and the sectarian Shia militias in Iraq, Lebanon, Yemen, once $100 to $150 billion of frozen Iranian assets are freed? What is Mr. Obama's strategy on that issue? This is the biggest question, and we've been asking officials. I've been meeting here in the past couple of days here in Washington. We don't have an answer for that. We're not getting an answer. Meanwhile, in the region, especially in Syria, death, destruction, and sectarian cleansing on an unprecedented scale have become daily routine. And the main culprit on the ground are the Iranian Revolutionary Guards and the Shia militias they control, Hezbollah Lebanon, Iraqi Shia militias, and, of course, the Afghani one that are there. We estimate about 5,000 to 10,000 Hezbollah militias fighting in Syria now, about 20,000 to 30,000 Afghani, about 10,000 Iraqi, about 1,000 to 2,000 Iranian Revolutionary Guard commanders who are on the ground fighting the war against the rebels in Syria on behalf of the Assad regime. In our opinion, there is no more Assad regime since about 2013. Everything on the ground is controlled. Every military operation, the military secret services, the borders where the so-called regime is there are controlled by the Iranian regime. Without the military and economic support of Iran, there would be no more Assad regime since about 2013. That's why we claim since now a year that these so-called regime-held areas in Syria are occupied by Iran. So since late September 2015, these Iranian-controlled militias have been supported by Russia, which has been mainly bombing Syrian rebels backed by the U.S. and its allies. Daesh, so-called Islamic State, is rarely targeted. So the lack of hope and serious support is driving many Sunni Muslims in Syria and in Iraq to join Daesh and Qaeda in groups because of Iran's sectarian policies in the region. We have released in May 2015 a report called Silent Sectarian Cleansing in Syria, where we have shown and proven that Iran and the Hezbollah are massively involved in supporting the Assad militiamen and Shabiha on the ground to kick out of many areas in Damascus and Homs and elsewhere Sunnis to create everywhere more Shia enclaves, especially in Damascus along the Lebanese border and in the coastline. You need to check out that report on our website and you will see how a massive sectarian cleansing is happening in Syria and is being even now happening more and more and strongly. And we know also of a sectarian cleansing happening in parts of Iraq, especially along the border with Iran, where the Shia militias there, supported by Iran, have kicked out all the Sunnis living there in the area. So Sunni Muslims, and not only them, believe that the U.S. has sold out Syria and Iraq to Iran for the sake of the nuclear deal signed with Iran in July 2015. Even worse, many in the Middle East believe that the U.S. has stopped caring about values like freedom and human rights. This is very bad. News of Western business delegations visiting Iran to sign new deals is further fueling the propaganda machine of Daesh. I remember days after the signing of the deal in Vienna in July, last July, you had already the German finance minister with a huge delegation traveling to Tehran I think it was one day directly afterwards. He was the first there. And since then, it's not stopping. Non-stop people there making connections and waiting for the money to flow next year. It looks really bad. It looks as if really everybody sold out the region just for the sake of the nuclear deal and some dollars they will make next year. So empty promises by the U.S. to seriously support moderate rebels are eroding what is left of Western credibility in the region. Not acting decisively in Syria is making the situation worse by the day. And now Russia has stepped in and capitalizing on the failure of the West to act. The result is more radicalization, extremists, more terror, more refugees, and a disintegrating Middle East. This, ladies and gentlemen, cannot be in the interest of the U.S. It just cannot be. I cannot understand it. By the way, when people say President Obama or the West don't have a strategy to deal with the situation of Daesh and Syria, I don't agree. I think they do have one. They have one. They have a very smart but unfortunately quite cynical one. In our opinion, the U.S. and their allies are following in Syria a strategy of slowly, very slowly bleeding Iran and Hezbollah and now Putin there. I was told by numerous Western officials in Europe lately, we're going to watch now Putin fail in Syria. After we're watching already Hezbollah and Iran fail. Now we're watching also Putin fail. Fantastic. So the rebels are getting enough weapons not to lose, but definitely not to win. If the Iranians and the Russians come in and start bombing more and fighting more, okay, they get more TOW missiles, but never enough to win. So we have a situation where whatever the Iranians do, they cannot win, but they cannot lose. Same thing with the rebels. And the strategy behind it is that we do it this way until we have the nuclear deal and until we have the nuclear deal implemented. And then we see. This is what I keep on hearing when I speak to officials in European capitals and sometimes even here. Yeah. And this is very cynical because it's happening at this with a horrible price we are paying in the region. So how to end the war in Syria? How to prevent Iran from spending more on terror? We believe that the U.S. and its allies have to treat the war in Syria as an international armed conflict that involves a foreign occupation by Iran and Russia on the one hand, and a liberation struggle by the Syrian people against this occupation on the other. And the U.S. and its allies should refer the situation in Syria to the International Criminal Court or set up a special criminal court like the one of Hariri to investigate all war crimes and crimes against humanity committed in Syria. We want a special court or the ICC one day to indict people like Assad, General Qasem Soleimani from the Quds Force of the Sepah Pasdaran, the Revolutionary Guards, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah from Hezbollah, and all other people like Baghdadi and so on, who are responsible for all the atrocities happening in Syria. At the same time, Russia should be pressured with more economic sanctions and diplomatic isolation so that it disengages from Iran and becomes part of the solution rather than being part of the problem. And President Obama should finally fulfill his promise by arming and training enough moderate Syrian rebels, not only to fight Daesh and Al-Qaeda, but also the Assad troops or what remains of his army, the Iranian Pasdaran, the Hezbollah, the Shia militias, and so on. No-fly zones should protect civilians and allow humanitarian access throughout Syria in line with the international responsibility to protect norm. We believe that only the U.S. can prevent Syria and the Middle East from further disintegrating and chaos. Only the U.S. can lead a serious international coalition that can help Syrians build a democratic state where the rule of law prevails and where there is no place for Bashar al-Assad and his supporters. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Fouad, for Thank this report that really helps quantify what so many in the region have been feeling and fearing, this growing Iranian investment and intervention in the region. You call upon the U.S. to do more. The U.S. every day does a little bit more. It's a sort of creeping engagement, certainly not what many people in this room would like to see. But you know, it's the last year of the Obama administration, so we probably won't see much more. But what about, you know, if Iran can play this game and play it so effectively, I mean, can I draw you out to talk a little bit about the other regional players like Turkey and and Saudi Arabia and what they should be doing more of to counter Iranian influence?
Yeah. Kate, everybody in the region, all the allies of the U.S. in the region, the Turks, the Gulf Arabs, the Europeans, I've been speaking to many officials from all these countries for the past 2-3 years, and everybody wants to do more, but they're not allowed to do more. There is somebody here in the White House who's micromanaging in partly the war in Syria and is seeing to it that everything is managed in a way that doesn't provoke the Iranians into getting out of the nuclear deal in the past 2 years and stopping the negotiations. So the whole policy of the U.S. administration has been for the past years to get a nuclear deal with Iran. And anything that would provoke too much the Iranians in Syria or elsewhere would have led to the collapse of the deal. And that's why Mr. Obama has always said, okay, we support the rebels enough, but not too much. When the regime, when the Iranians and the Hezbollah use chemical weapons in Ghouta, in Damascus, in August 2013 and crossed the so-called red line set by the president, no, he did not bomb them. Because if he would have done it, we would have had probably now maybe a free Syria, but we would have had a small, strong war. We would have had something horrific for a couple of weeks and everything would have may have finished. But then the nuclear deal and the nuclear negotiation would have been dead. So that's why we believe that wasn't done. So everything happening since then, since the so-called red line that was crossed without a retaliation, is carried out with the policy behind, we want the nuclear deal. We do enough, but not enough to break that deal. And everybody wants to go further to save Syria, to save the region, but no, the nuclear deal. And now we've been told all the time, we need to implement the nuclear deal. If now we do too much in Syria, if we give the rebels enough weapons to, let's say, liberate Aleppo and create a region in the north which is supported by the West, Air Force, and so on, like Benghazi, you know, at the time of Gaddafi during the revolution, then the Iranians will go crazy and everything will not be implemented and we lost the nuclear deal. It's very difficult to argue when you speak to officials here in Washington who defend that policy behind closed doors and tell you, we need to have the Iranians first dismantle the nuclear installations and not being able anymore to build a nuclear bomb unless they want to. It will take them too long then. And then we see for the rest. And we argue always, guys, if you keep on being so weak in front of them, they're going to have the nuclear bomb, they're going to have Syria and Iraq and Lebanon, and the whole region will be in their hand. So you have to be a bit tougher, a bit smarter than them. And they are now outsmarting you, in our opinion. Voilà.
I think you'd like to open the floor to questions.
Hello, thank you for your talk. My name is Kira Jume. I'm from the American-Iranian Council. I thought the talk was very interesting, but I'm a little bit concerned in terms of some of the sweeping statements made about what Sunni Muslims want in the Middle East. Beyond my role at AEIC, I'm also a professor of Middle East politics who spent many years in the field as recently as last year. And that's a concern. My largest concern is actually the report. Now, obviously, I haven't had a long time to look at it, but you talked about extremely reliable Western sources, but we know that when we're doing research, a lot of reliable sources are actually going into the field and getting primary sources. The majority of the sources that I've seen quickly are from newspaper reports and from Western sources, but in terms of any type of academic standard for actually how do we know what we know, I find the report incredibly flimsy, and I understand that many people from your organization are in exile, so obviously that poses a large challenge to research, but maybe getting people in the field to actually be able to go out and verify might be helpful, because this is, in my opinion, very weak academically in terms of presenting it as an academic report.
Thank you. Yes. Listen, I'm not sure if I would call it academic, but We had at the end, when we finished the report with that Economic Research Institute, so much information. And we downsized it to something where we believe this is the most credible. There are no more information about what Iran has been spending in the region. Okay, nothing else, because Iran hardly says anything. They're very secretive about everything they say. And the newspaper reports and the official reports we've been quoting are all sources from US or Europeans where we believe they are credible. You can challenge that and say this is flimsy. Fine, we accept it. We think this is the most conservative. As I said before, we think even Iran spends much more, much, much more. The drama is that they don't say how much they're spending, and the Europeans and the American intelligence agencies don't release the information they have. They don't. One day they will. And then the number you have here will be much higher. I'm sure for that.
George Bailey with the Lebanese Information Center. Fuad, what do you make of the argument now we hear sometimes about the changes in dynamics after the Russian intervention, that the Iranian role now is becoming secondary in Syria, that Russia is taking the lead, and maybe this whole sectarian thing will be maybe diminished, curtailed, and maybe some of the militias, reading some reports about some Hezbollah fighters going back in Lebanon, leaving Syria, etc. Is it true that Russia now is maybe taking the lead and Iranian role is becoming really very secondary in Syria? Thank you.
You see, at the beginning, when the Russian intervention started, the whole Hezbollah environment in Beirut was in joy. They thought, this is it. In a couple of weeks, we will win the war. This is it. With the Russian support, we will make it. Everybody was quite jubilant in that area. And there were talk at that time that we will not need anymore to send so many fighters anymore to Lebanon, to Syria and die there. We send more Afghani, you know, and Iraqi, especially more Afghani, who are cheaper for everybody. Yeah. A couple of weeks later, everything became a bit more, let's say, depressing for these guys. They had to send even more troops. And the Afghani militia men they've been sending from Iran have proven to be extremely not so motivated, no, like they wanted, put it politely, yeah, because these guys were dying like, how do you say, in Lebanon, like flies, and they were not fighting the way they were expected to fight. And the Iranians were even forced to send even hundreds of more pasdaran, and many have been killed. What really shocked these guys when they attacked from everywhere around Hama, Homs, and Aleppo with the support of the Russians, they thought everybody would run away. They didn't. In the contrary, they fought like lions. And the U.S., via their friend in the region, sent them hundreds of TOW missiles. And these TOW missiles basically played a very crucial military role on the ground, because they can hit the Russian and the tanks of the regime of the Iranians and Hezbollah and armored personnel carriers and jeeps kilometers away without them being able to react before. And basically, they did not win any. They won here a bit, but lost here a bit. And we are still basically almost there like we were before the Russians came. And everybody now on that side of the war is quite depressed. No, and they are bleeding and they know how to get out. Behind closed doors, in Vienna and elsewhere, the Russians are dying to make a deal. Putin is realizing he made a big mistake and he doesn't know how to get out. And I don't see anybody in Europe or here now offering him a serious way out. They are watching him fail. And he will fail with the Iranians and with the Hezbollah. But how and when, we'll see.
Thank you very much. My name is Tyler Thompson. I'm with United for a Free Syria. My question to you is there anything that the Iranians could be doing in Syria that they aren't doing now because of a lack of funds? So, like, I guess the question is, with the new influx of the Iranian deal money, are there any sort of game-changing things that Iran has been waiting to do?
Yeah. Look, in our opinion, the more they do in Syria, the more they spend there, the more they send people, the more the rebels will get weapon, and the more they will fight them, and the more they will bleed. It's basically a vicious circle they are in, and they are realizing it, and they are getting also more and more vicious and more angry. So the drama is, in the whole situation in Syria, is that the Russians and the Iranians might surprise us with very, very horrible things in the area, in the region, no, as a reaction, because when they realize they are being left to bleed there and there will be no deal in Vienna until they fall apart, until Putin maybe has to withdraw and everything collapses, they will be very vicious, and this is our biggest fear. What will they do exactly? How will they react? The game that is being played now down there, and managed very well or very badly, as you see it, from the White House and from Turkey and so on, but mainly from here, is how to see to it that it doesn't fall apart totally and goes crazy in Syria until the nuclear deal is implemented. There are still many people in Washington, less and less people in Europe, who believe that that nuclear deal will ever take place. Yeah, because you need to know one thing. Or you need to ask yourself a big question. Why is Iran spending so much money on somebody called Bashar al-Assad? Why? Is he worth it? I mean, think about it a little bit. Why are they doing it? Why are they investing or have been investing in Hezbollah since the early 80s, billions of dollars? Yeah, and establishing there a huge army, the Pasdaran in Lebanon, their Iranian army in Lebanon, their biggest army outside Iran in Lebanon, a fighting force which is maybe the best in the region after the Israeli one. Okay? Why are they doing it? They set up Hezbollah because this is their first line of defense. With the missiles on Israel, if you bomb our nuclear installations, if you destroy our nuclear military dreams, Tel Aviv will be under missiles. And they wanted to build a second line of defense south of Saudi Arabia in Yemen that failed with the Saudi attacks supported by the U.S. and their Arab allies. Yeah. And they will not give up Syria. If Syria falls, yeah, Hezbollah will fall because all the weapons to Hezbollah since August 2006 come via Syria. Remember, after the war, Hezbollah, Israel, in 2006, we had a UN resolution saying no more weapons coming to any militia to Lebanese ports. And we have since then a UN flotilla, Western ships, warships with UN flags, preventing anything coming to Hezbollah via Lebanon. So everything comes via Syria. Syria falls, Hezbollah falls. Iran's nuclear dreams are over, and the regime feels threatened. That's why they are fighting in Syria. They will not give away that Damascus corridor, Hama Hummus coastline, unless they have the bomb. They don't have the bomb. They have the bomb. They don't care about everything, but not before. So now we have a situation which is extremely dangerous in the next couple of months or 1 or 2 years maximum, where Iran is bleeding economically, Russia is bleeding economically, both of them soon on the verge of economic collapse, fighting and bleeding in Syria. Iran wants to have the bomb at whatever cost and playing games, and Russia wants the sanctions to be taken away, accepting that Crimea belongs to them, and then they might decide to get out. They will not get it. Nobody will accept they swallowed Crimea. Nobody, will take the sanctions away from them until they get out from there. And Iran will not get the bomb, and nobody will let them have the bomb. And at the same time, we're fighting them in Syria and bleeding them. So imagine the toxic mix of all these things together. It's crazy. And it's getting worse. That's what I've been asking for the past year. Do something now. The more you postpone, the more anything you want to do to end that war will be more difficult. And everything we're suggesting to end the war is bad, is bloody, okay? But tell me something better. And in 1 month, it will be worse. Yeah?
Hi, my name is Nina. I'm with IRI. So my question is that it seems that you do advocate for a greater U.S. role in Syria. But since U.S. hasn't been very successful doing that in either Afghanistan or Iraq, how do you think they will succeed in Syria? And another question would be, since U.S. and Iran are on the same side in the fight against ISIL, what's the alternative? So if more funding, if Iran sends more funding to groups that are fighting ISIL, isn't that good for the U.S.? And if we don't do that, then what is the alternative?
Okay. I'll start with ISIS, with Daesh. I don't think they are on the same side fighting Daesh. It looks like that a bit in Iraq, but definitely not very much in Syria, yeah? I mean, Daesh is being contained by the U.S. and their allies. No, if you get too close to our Kurdish friends in northern Iraq, we bomb the hell out of you. Or else, whatever you do with the Pasdaran and the Iranian-supported Iraqi militias down there, we support you a little bit, but also not too much, because Iran is bleeding there. And the Iraqi-controlled Shia regime, with all their Shia-controlled militia, with the Shia militia controlled by Iran, funded by Iran. It's a very weird situation where you have the U.S., we say, sorry, playing the game as if they are working together to fight Daesh, but they're not. And in Syria, Daesh has a huge border, you know, area with Turkey. They come in and come out. They're still functioning relatively well. Sometimes they get hit there, they get hit there and here. But in the final effect, they're still operating and still fighting at top party against the regime. Okay? And the Americans are allied with Kurdish militias who are a bit PKK and partly supported by, you know, allied with the regime and with the Iranians, but also with the US, and the Turks don't like it. It's very messy. If you want to fight Daesh seriously, you need to convince the Syrians that you don't only want to fight Daesh, but also the regime and the Iranians fighting with the regime and the other militias supporting that regime, like Hezbollah and so on. Then you will have a real fight against Daesh. What is everything which is being done against Daesh now in Syria or Iraq is half-hearted in order not to create a big mess to have the nuclear deal implemented. And then we see, this is what we're having there. It's a mess. Okay? Your first question, I forgot now, the first part.
That was about you advocating for greater
involvement. Yes, yes.
And why is that
given the failures in Afghanistan?
Yeah. Look, nobody with a bit of sanity in his mind is asking the U.S. to enter Syria and invade it again, you know, with 150,000 troops, or to repeat the mistakes done in Libya or in Iraq or in Afghanistan. Nobody. What we want and what everybody in the region is advocating, or what the Syrians are screaming for, are help us build a strong free Syrian army and not 50 people only. You know? There are plans and there are enough people there to have very quickly a very strong free Syrian army that would go in with Arab support and with Turkish support and with American support from the air and special forces and all. There are many plans for things to be done in a way to liberate Syria from everybody, from Daesh, Qaeda, the Syrian the regime, the Iranian Pasdaran, Hezbollah, and the Russians. There are plans to do that. But if it's implemented tomorrow, and Mr. Obama says if it's implemented tomorrow, if we do anything serious tomorrow, then the nuclear deal is dead. Again, we come back to the nuclear deal. This is what is preventing a real solution of two huge problems in the region, the Iranian occupation of Syria and Daesh. This is it. So we're waiting and waiting and waiting until Godot comes, if you remember that game, you know? We're waiting for Godot, and in the meantime, the region is falling apart, refugees are swimming everywhere, in every direction. Yeah, Daesh is getting more people supporting them. The Sunni are going crazy, and voila. And if you think Iran will give up the nuclear dream, then you believe that pigs can fly and nuclear powers are safe, you know?
Voila. Question over here from Fuad.
Good afternoon, for the Global Policy Associates and adjunct professor at George Washington University. Fuad, I want to hear you speak more about the numbers, if you may, and I think it's a question that's somewhat related to what my friend here asked about. You mentioned that there's quite a bit of Hezbollah fighters, mm-hmm. but also Shia Iraqi fighters and Afghani mm-hmm. fighters who are dying,
yes.
and that Iran spends quite a bit of money on these fighters.
Yes, yes.
I was wondering if you could talk mm-hmm. about how much it costs, you know, these dead mm-hmm. fighters cost, and specifically when Iran has mm-hmm. to compensate their families.
Yes.
And then also the injured and the yes. hospitals and whatnot, mm-hmm. and then how that factors mm-hmm. into the broader mm-hmm. calculation of numbers that you've worked from the ground up.
Yeah, yeah. A couple of figures, we didn't have them in the report also, just to be on the safe side so that nobody says, you're claiming something, you know, and so on. We wanted to have only the report, absolutely credible information. So we know from our Shia brothers and sisters in southern Lebanon and Lebanon that whenever you have one Hezbollah fighter dying in Syria, their family receives $50,000 as a compensation. We're talking about a simple soldier. No, a foot soldier, basically, with no family and not married, no children, okay? If the person is married, a commander and so on, that goes up, can go up to 100,000. And then we know from friends who have documented exactly how many fighters have died already in Syria. We documented more than 1,600, but the figure is at least double as much until now, if not even by 4,000 or 5,000. But let's say 1,600 we documented, who died in Syria. And then you have at least double as much who are maimed and injured. That costs also a lot of money. Then you have the children and the family members and the widows who are supported by Hezbollah for years and years and years for school, university, and so on. So the costs add up and add up and add up. Then we played a little bit of a game and said, okay, if we have 5,000 Hezbollah fighters in Syria fighting with the salaries of between $500 and $1,000 a month, commander or age and so on and so on, then you have the logistics and the transport and so on, and then you have each one of them has one Kalashnikov, a pistol, and the ammunition and so on. You get for each one of them at least between $5,000 and $10,000 of cost for that person per month to feed him, transport him, giving the ammunition and so on. And we don't talk about RPGs, heavy ammunition, mortar rounds, trucks, and so on. And just for these 5,000, that small army, we're going into the millions every month. Yeah, we did not add this information also in the report because we said, okay, that goes too much. Let's stick to the what is really that what cannot be, you know, questioned. 150% bulletproof, you know, concrete cannot be questioned. But then you add, and then if you want to continue, you know, you have 20 to 30,000 Afghani soldiers, you know, the Iraqi ones, the Masdaran. Wow, man, Iran is spending so much. If the Iranian people knew how much their government, maybe you could tell your Iranian, U.S. counsel to inform the Iranian people how much these guys are wasting outside their borders, yeah, on killing people, on destabilizing just to have a nuclear bomb. It's crazy. In history, nothing. I mean, if you imagine, how would Iran look like today if they hadn't gone this way in the 80s? Towards a nuclear path with all the destabilization in the area, exporting the revolution, you know, creating Hezbollah, fighting all these wars and so on. How would Iran look like today? Makes me cry, you know.
That's a good question in the back here.
Gentlemen? U.S. taxpayer.
No U.S. taxpayer.
Interest. No other interest but U.S.
You're
taxpayer.
The most, important
one. I live in
Washington
State, long ways from here. What percentage of the Iranians, the population,
yeah,
support the government of Iran?
Oh, good question. Yeah, okay. Before the war in Syria and the rise of Daesh and so on, we would have said maybe 20-30% of the Iranians support the regime without second thought, because they are part of the system of the Pasdaran, the Basij, the economic system, and they live from that regime, okay? And the rest would be against them, okay? Now, we would say that these 20-30% have now 50-60 maybe more who are not with them but who prefer to have the regime than anything else. The regime in Iran has succeeded in the past couple of years via an excellent communication strategy, and because of the mistakes of the US and their allies and the Arabs and so on, many mistakes, yeah, to convince the Iranians who hate the regime in Iran and outside Iran that you are much better off with the guys with the black things, you know, and who go to pray all the time but don't really pray, you know. This is what they achieved. You are much better with us than if you dare have a revolution. Because if you dare do a revolution in Syria, in Iran, then you might have something like in Syria, Libya, or Iraq. And then the Sunni loonies from Daesh and co. will come and kill every single Shia in Iran. That's why now you have something called massive fear in Iran. Fear from the regime, and fear from a revolution, and fear from Daesh, and fear from the Sunnis, and fear from everything. Mm-hmm. Even the Iranians living abroad don't even dare anymore to criticize or say anything. They say, let's keep it this way now. You know, everything is fine, and they look at Rouhani and Zarif and say, hopefully these guys will be the ones running the country and the so-called moderates and so on. Mm-hmm. There are no moderates in Iran, in the regime. It's all a show. These guys are a mask of a very terrible regime. Since Rouhani came to power, the number of people being executed for their political opinion has been much more than at the time of Ahmadinejad. Check the websites of Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, and then you know what kind of regime we have there. So we have a situation in Iran that is not at all ready for any opposition to oppose this regime. It's a stalemate of fear.
Thank you. Gareth Porter, independent investigative journalist. I have a couple of questions about your sort of timeline, which has to do, one, with the motivation of the Iranians, mm-hmm, with regard to their support for Hezbollah, their arming of Hezbollah, particularly missiles.
Yeah.
And the other one having to do with the motivation of the United States with regard to Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And with regard to the first one, the question here is whether you're not forgetting the Israeli factor in mm-hmm. this situation, mm-hmm. Which I paid a good deal of attention to as a historian.
Yeah.
The Israelis have been threatening to use long-range air power to mm-hmm. attack Iran since mm-hmm. the early to mid-1990s. Mm-hmm. The Iranians began to arm Hezbollah seriously mm-hmm. in the 1990s, beginning of the
80s.
First decade of this century.
Hezbollah in the 80s, since 83. Hezbollah since 93.
I don't know, but I'm talking about missiles which could reach Israel.
Yes.
That was the idea.
Yes.
So they began to develop that policy in response, I think it's, I would argue, to the threat.
Yeah.
But on the American side, the question I have for you is whether you would agree with Charles Lister's very detailed analysis showing that by the mid to late 2012, the jihadists were already in firm control of the opposition to Assad.
Yes.
That they were very well armed. They were rapidly gaining adherence.
Yes.
And that they were viewed as the ones who were the future of the opposition, the future of the revolution against Assad.
Yeah.
Under those circumstances, the question obviously occurred to the Obama administration.
Mm-hmm.
What is going to be the result of trying to push more arms into Syria?
Yes.
Isn't that a fair question for
Absolutely.
A government to ask?
Absolutely. Thank you for this question. The U.S. and their allies have done so many mistakes in Syria. From the beginning of the revolution, we were screaming and yelling, watch it, the jihadis are coming from everywhere. Watch Al-Qaeda. Watch the loonies coming from Iraq, from everywhere, you know, undermining the revolution. And watch what the Iranian regime and the Assad regime are doing in Syria at the beginning of the revolution and in 2012. The Iranian regime, Qasem Soleimani and Hafez Bashar al-Assad, released hundreds of jihadis in their prisons, who they put them in 2007 inside, including Mr. Zahran Alloush, the head of Ahrar al-Sham, a Wahhabi, a total loony, okay, an assassin. Yeah, they released him and released other of these people to undermine the revolution and to make a sectarian conflict, and they succeeded. And these guys have been taken over by many of the allies of the Americans in the region and have been supported. And we've been warning against that. Watch it. Don't make out of Syria another Afghanistan where you support jihadis and crazy loonies to fight other crazy loonies who are Assad and the Shia militias and the Iranians and so on. But this is what happened. And we were always demanding and asking support the moderate Syrian rebels, the secular ones. They have been supported, not enough. Sometimes less, sometimes more, and so on. Today, how many of the Syrian rebels are Islamists, jihadis, Qaeda, Daesh, and so on? It varies, you know. They could be between 40 to 60, 70%, and the rest are secular. Most of the fighters of Jabhat al-Nusra, who is Al-Qaeda, which is the biggest fighting force in Syria, fighting against the regime, most of the fighters are not jihadists. They are fighting with them because it is the only organization giving them basically the structure and the weapons and so on to fight against the regime. If you go in with a moderate Syrian army, even a small one, and you put money on the ground, you tell them, come guys, you come now with us, they will leave them. Daesh is a different story. You'll have to annihilate them. You'll have to destroy them. It's possible. Qaeda people like Zahran Alloush and Jabhat al-Nusra, most of the fighters are not jihadists. The leadership and some of them, yes. Okay? You need to change the policy, and then you have another picture of everything what's going on there. It's a political decision.
So but support Jabhat al-Nusra as the moderate alternative?
No. Sorry, you have to fight them. You have to fight them all. You have to fight Jabhat al-Nusra and every single jihadi group there. And you have to convince the fighters to join you because most of the fighters of Jabhat al-Nusra are not jihadists. This is what we know from the people we talk to in the region and in Syria. Okay, that's what I'm saying.
You must admit at this late stage, it's very difficult to build a moderate rebel force.
Absolutely.
Given
Absolutely.
The associations that so many
yes.
people have, it's
very
difficult.
It's very difficult.
It started in 2012, is my point.
It's very difficult. It's getting difficult every day. It's getting difficult every day. It was very difficult already 2 years ago. Now it's extremely difficult. You're right. I'm not saying it's easy.
There's a question in the middle here, the gentleman in the middle.
Mm-hmm. Peter Humphrey, intelligence analyst and a former diplomat. It seems that it's going to take about 2 years for the money to move all the way from its frozen accounts through the Iranian bureaucracy mm-hmm. onto actual manufacturing of arms and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
2 years is a long time. And in that time, ISIS may be stupid enough to bomb more things in Turkey, which might finally invite some Turkish tanks to move south. They may be stupid enough to attack Israel, their ultimate enemy,
mm-hmm.
and God only knows what the reaction would be to that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just saying, what are the odds of this being overtaken by events in that sort of two-year mm-hmm. time frame?
I think in the next 6 months we will be overtaken by events. Not in the next 2 years, the next 6 months. We have a couple of horror scenarios which I would not like to share, but there are many things that will happen. Look at where we were 6 months ago, 3 months ago. Things are developing very quickly, very, very quickly, and getting more and more out of control. And then they will have to react here. They will have no choice. I think they will have no choice. They will have to go. At some point, you will have to go in. And the Arabs have said, we're willing to go in with you. But support us. Give us the green light. Like in Yemen. We need to do something in Syria like in Yemen. Big. And it's going to be very bloody. It's a very bad. It's horrible. But we will have no choice. Tell me another alternative to stop the insanity and to prevent Iran from having the bomb and to annihilate once and for all Daesh and the leadership of Nusra and all these jihadis.
Hi, my name is Stephen Turner. I was wondering how you would like to see various Lebanese political parties capitalize off of the vulnerabilities of Hezbollah in Syria.
I will answer a bit in that direction, but I hope that will be the answer for your question. The big art now of saving Lebanon for descending into another civil war and chaos because of Hezbollah's insane intervention in Syria on behalf of the Iranians and Bashar al-Assad will be how to see to it when they will be defeated in Syria, and they will be inevitably, how to see to it that there will be no revenge in Lebanon, yeah, that they will get back and we will say, okay, fine, no, take your weapons, give it to the Lebanese army, become nice now, finished, you know, state in a state, army for yourself in Lebanon, give us everything, and then find a structure, let's say a formula, whereby we will not have a civil war, and everybody will trust everybody, and everything will be fine. That will be very difficult. We know that this is what the March 14 leadership is always, you know, saying and sending the messages to Hezbollah. But Hezbollah, until today, and for some time to come, cannot decide on its own. Hezbollah is Iran's army there. They get their orders from Tehran. Okay? So if they start to become a truly Lebanese party, they will have to cut the relationship with Iran. And until this happens, we don't know if it will ever happen. You know? But there are attempts to prevent this to happen whenever they will be defeated in Syria and have to get out. Because, what they're doing in Syria, it is their Vietnam. They will never win. It's impossible. It's crazy that they went in. You know? Totally insane. Suicidal in a way. And let's hope they're not suicidal when they go back. You need to know that the current situation in Lebanon is extremely volatile. Look what almost happened in Lebanon a couple of weeks ago when after the terror attack inside the southern suburbs of Beirut. You know, the two guys who blew themselves up and killed almost 40 people or more. We almost had clashes between Sunni and Shia, you know, in Burj Dabrajni around the area, yeah? And Nasrallah and Hezbollah had to call many people not to do it. And Hariri and the other side also. Everybody was calming everybody. So it went well because there's still a consensus, including the regional powers, Saudi, Iran, and so on. We don't fight our war in Syria and Lebanon. Until now. Who knows? You know, if somebody decides somewhere, now we're going to give the Iranians and Hezbollah real hell, they can blow it up, you know, in Lebanon against them and create a new front. But that would be insane. That will be beyond insanity. You know, let's hope it will not happen. Because weapons are enough. Everybody has weapons in Lebanon now. Everybody. More than enough. And Hezbollah knows it.
Hi,
Hi, my name is Nicole Catulli. I'm an Iraq researcher with Tesla Government, Inc., so my question's Iraq-specific. The senior leadership of Iraq has supported the National Reconciliation Project as key to the long-term stabilization of Iraq, including the current reform movement, greater inclusion of tribes, de-Ba'athification, and decentralization, specifically giving greater independence to the provinces and managing their insecurity.
Yes.
And what role do you think Iran has to play in this process?
In Iraq?
Mm-hmm.
I really prefer not to answer any questions about Iraq because I am not a real expert on that. I know a lot, but not so good like Lebanon and Syria. You know, I don't want to say something wrong there. Yeah? Okay, please ask experts on Iraq. Thank you.
We have a former Iraqi ambassador.
Yes, yes, please. Please.
There's a question over here.
Yeah, Ken Meyercord, World Docs. The anti-Assad states, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, mm-hmm. the Emirates, the United States, mm-hmm. have much deeper pockets than Iran.
Yes.
We know the United States spent $500 million to train a couple of dozen fighters who were immediately captured or defected. Do you have any feeling for how much these states have spent in total in supporting regional militias?
Oof. To be honest, no, we don't. But what we know is that the Gulf Arab states are ready to finance much more, to finance a free Syrian army, to finance the liberation of Syria, and to go for it if the Americans give the finally the green light. This we know. But we don't know how much. We have no idea. No idea. It must.
Anyone studying it?
Yeah, you know, when we did this work on this report, we also checked out if there is any other information about that. There is almost nothing. Nothing. Almost nothing. Zero. You know, I mean, if you want to do a research, you need to have at least somebody who did something about it. Nobody said anything about it. Nobody's saying.
Right there.
Yeah, you need to go to Langley, you know, and ask these guys. But maybe, hopefully they know. But
the U.S. Treasury is supposedly going to look into where all those white Toyotas that...
we have no idea.
Islamic,
you know?
State used to take over northern Iraq came from.
Look, definitely lots of Gulf money was, you know, went in the billions into Syria, and not only into the weapons and so on for the rebels of all colors, but also for humanitarian aid, yeah, and so on. But we have no idea. Sorry. No?
Fuad, you say Iran will never give up Syria, but do you think they would give up Assad? Do you see them ever agreeing to a transition or a compromise if a role for Iran was guaranteed in the future of Syria?
Yes. The Iranians will give up a lot of things if they get what they want, which is the bomb. Yeah? Now, in Vienna, the Vienna talks, what are they talking there? They're talking, okay, we dump Assad, we don't dump Assad. For Iran, it's not about Assad the name. It's about Assad the regime. It's about Assad the symbol of a regime. And when they say we will not dump Assad, it means we will not allow anybody to take over Syria and not let us anymore ship weapons to Hezbollah via Syria. This is what is being said when they say Assad. So when the Americans say no Assad, it means no more weapons to Hezbollah via Syria. And when the Iranians and the Russians say Assad has to be part of it, it means we still have enough control of Damascus, the borderline, and the coastline to ship weapons to Hezbollah into Syria, into Lebanon. This is what is being said behind, you know, between the hidden thing of the Assad regime. Yeah. So it's a very weird situation where we have negotiations happening and the talk publicly being focusing only on something called the Assad regime and President Assad. Assad is nothing. He's probably maybe even a hostage of the Pasdaran in Damascus. He's nothing. He's a puppet, you know. Again, it's all about the bomb. If tomorrow Iran has the bomb, if tomorrow Iran decides to run for the bomb and the U.S. does not give the green light for the regional allies to stop them, yeah, and to participating in stopping them, then Iran will have no problem dumping Assad in Syria and Hezbollah. Then mission accomplished after 30 years. You see, you need to know one thing about the Iranian regime. These guys, since 1979, 1980, believe that everybody out there is out to get them. Remember the Iran-Iraq war, Saddam Hussein being sent inside with the support of the Arab Gulf regimes and with the U.S. and the Europeans. remember the sanctions, remember the fact that they have American forces all around them, that everybody in the region hate them, all the regimes, okay? Look at what's happening now here in Syria since 2011, and them bleeding also systematically in Syria. So they are super mega paranoia, okay? And they have good reasons to believe it also. That's why they want the bomb. They want the bomb to secure the regime. Just listen to these guys carefully, read what they're saying in Persian, in their media, and you understand in what psyche they are living in, okay? Give them the bomb, they will drop everything else, but they will not get the bomb. Everybody I talk to here or in Europe, they will never let them have the bomb. So we are heading towards a confrontation, unfortunately. Me, as a former, you know, Greenpeace activist, and I am a nonviolent person, but I'm not a stupid pacifist, you know, not a naive pacifist, all right? And it's very difficult to say that with that regime, you will have to play it tough and at the same time negotiate. We think it's a very good idea, finally, that we are negotiating with the Iranians in Vienna. Finally, we're talking to the guys who are running the show in Syria and not to some guys Assad sends to Vienna before with the okay of Qasem Soleimani. Very good. But in the final effect, what do you do to pressure enough the Iranians to give up the bomb, get out of Syria, get out of Iraq, disarm Hezbollah, leave Yemen in peace, and at the same time have the feeling we're not out there to get you to pull down your regime if you become good guys? That will be very difficult. And that's why I understand why you laugh. It's crazy. This is the situation where we are. We are in a deadlock, which is horrible. A horrible deadlock. Yeah? With no trust on both sides. Yeah? Yeah? And too many bad guys fighting each other, you know, in the region. It's horrible.
Well, I think on this very small question, we're going to have to end. I'm sorry if I didn't get to everybody's questions, but Fuad will be here to take your questions personally. So please join me in thanking Fuad Hamda.
Thank you.